are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, April 5th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, in studio, Alex Perrine, to look back on this week that was, and also into the darkest abyss, Mitch McConnell. Also on the program today, David Feldman, ostensibly to give us a movie recommendation. He won't do that.
No, actually he will.
Maybe he will. Also on the program today, White House pulls their head of ICE nominee, supposedly because he's not tough enough. Michael Cohen claims to have found new documents proving that Trump instructed him to lie to Congress. Elizabeth Warren calls for ending the filibuster. And is Kamala Harris backing off her Medicare for All pledge? Meanwhile, British police stationed outside the Ecuadorian embassy anticipating Julian Assange's ejection. And a federal court, Trump nominee, upholds a Kentucky law forcing doctors to show and describe fetal ultrasounds to women prior to allowing them to have an abortion. Meanwhile, Trump's tax cuts worked. J.P. Morgan's profits up $3.7 billion.
All right.
All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you could join us in studio. We are very happy to welcome back to the program Alex Perrine,
hey.
Writer at large,
mm-hmm.
Written for all sorts of publications, continues to do so. Alex, welcome back to the program. I should also just say, as a matter of house cleaning, recorded an interview with Glenn Greenwald about, I don't know, 45 minutes ago. And we will be posting that probably on Tuesday as I make my way to Las Vegas for the my biannual tort law conference excursion.
That's a very big day for you.
What's that?
A debate with Glenn and all my lawyer
friends. It was an interview.
Friends.
I don't know if I was.
No, it was. It was a very nice exchange. And I also thought, just to foreshadow, I mean, there was some common ground found at the end.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that. Oh, we should say this just in, the House has voted to end American involvement in the Yemen war. This is now, they have passed the Senate bill. That was all based on the War Resolutions Act, War Powers Resolution.
Yeah, War Powers, yeah.
And Donald Trump is expected to veto this. I think it would be his first veto.
It'll be his second veto.
And what was his first veto? Oh, the emergency powers, the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do not believe, I haven't seen the numbers here, but I do not believe that they will have enough votes in the Senate and the House to override the veto. So, but it is an important assertion of Congress's at least attempt to curb a and I would imagine maybe there's other things they can do in terms of funding, but I'm not 100% sure about that. This is a good sign anyways, at least that Congress is attempting to assert its power a little bit. So, Alex, and we could talk about the $3.7 billion because I still have fond memories of you on CNBC, talking about Jamie Dimon.
Yeah.
But
that was like being in the Vatican insulting the Pope.
But let's turn to another billionaire. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'm talking about Howard Schultz. He was on America's Election HQ last night. Was this last night? It was last night, right? Fox's town hall. And he was with Bret Baier and somebody else from Fox. I think it's okay. I think it's okay, folks.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
And Howard Schultz is there. Now, Howard Schultz is being advised by Steve Schmidt and Bill Burton. And they are getting paid millions.
A lot of money.
I am quite convinced they are making millions of dollars. And if I am wrong, they can sue me, and we can find
can
out in discovery. I've heard millions of dollars.
Oh, I believe that easily.
And they for literally $100,000, I would have given him this advice. Let me just say, but here it is. Here it is.
Don't sell yourself short.
Well, maybe I'm negotiating against myself, but
wow.
But I wouldn't, because I wouldn't want to have to hang around too much.
Yeah, right.
I think they get paid. I think they get paid like $5 for the advice, and then the rest of the millions of dollars is just to hang around and make him feel like he's smart.
Yeah,
that, I think, like when you buy drugs in high school, you have to hang out with the person.
Exactly. You got to get high with your dealer.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
That's a drag. So here's Alex. I mean, here's Alex. Here's Howard
Schultz.
Here's
Alex Perrine.
Here's Alex Perrine. Yeah. Here's Howard Schultz describing what he would do about immigration. This is listen.
It cannot be solved currently because of the ideology of both parties. But if I was fortunate enough to become president, this is what I can promise you. I'm about accountability. I'm about results. I would bring the people into the room. I would say, you cannot come in here with ideology or ego. What I want to do is I want to put an empty chair in the room, and that chair represents the American people. And we're not going to leave the room until we solve the problem for the American people. The problem that we have with both parties, the American people are not in the room.
I want to have a bulleted board here where I map this out. The American people are not in the room. So what we're going to do is we're going to put an empty chair. The way we're going to solve the American people not being in the room, the way we do that is to not have them in the room.
The problem is this chair represents the American people. If only we had another system whereby people representing the American people could be in Congress.
Much better to have the representatives of the American people unable to speak because they're an inanimate object.
Yes, exactly.
The coffee Willy Wonka has invented chairocracy.
I'm starting to do, because I've always been all about, like, you know, you cannot overinflate the intelligence of people like this, and running a coffee company and figuring out how to put more sugar in coffee is not the same as running a country. But it is reaching a point of like, how the fuck did this guy manage Starbucks? What?
Let me just, like, where would this idea, where have I heard this idea of an empty chair being an effective political tool? Let's travel back in time, ladies and gentlemen, to the 2012 Republican convention.
Quite a throwback here.
I haven't cried that hard since I found out that there's 23 million unemployed people in this country. This administration hasn't done enough to cure that. So I've got Mr. Obama sitting here, and I just was going to ask him a couple questions. So, Mr. President, how do you handle promises that you made? You don't have it. Okay. Well, I know even some of the people in your own party.
There he is. I mean, it's the American public was there too. The American people in the chair, the empty chair. Let's talk just a little bit about the idea that there's too much ideology. Like, how do you? There are a million different solutions to the immigration problem. The problem is that. What the immigration problem is a fun, everybody, like, there's like a lot of different statements of that problem.
Right. And I mean, it would be interesting to hear him state what he thinks the immigration problem is, because in stating that, you are declaring your ideology.
Right.
Like, you cannot just generalize it to be the problem. If you can't be specific about what you mean about that, because the second you're specific about it, you are declaring. And I mean, Schultz is the same thing has the same sort of brain disorder as other billionaires do, where he thinks he has no ideology. And then meanwhile, he's just like completely representative of his class, like in every single way. And he's got his positions are basically like Bloomberg positions. Like, I basically want business to be mostly left alone and I'm fairly culturally liberal. And Bloomberg eventually realized, like, repeatedly, every 4 years, Bloomberg realizes, oh, wait, I'm a Democrat. Right. there's a party that represents my interests. But Schultz is now, he's committed to this bit now. He's too committed to the bit to be like.
It really is. I mean, it's sort of like.
You got to say yes. You got to say yes to the premise.
It's just like somebody who travels to a different part of the country and go like, I don't have an accent. You have an accent. I don't have an accent. Well, you're the guy with the accent. I mean, whatever. Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to pick on Southern people.
Oh, it's all right. It's
a way to clean it up.
But
Sam.
I want to talk.
Good work there.
I want to get back to this notion of selling this lack of ideology, because we were talking about something before you came in. But first, I have to remind people that support for today's show comes from Third Love. Third Love uses data points generated by millions of women who have taken their Fit Finder quiz to design bras with breast size and shape in mind. The results, a perfect fit and a premium feel. Simply answer a few questions to find your perfect fit in 60 seconds. Then once you receive your bra, you can wear it, wash it, put it to the test for 60 days. And if you don't love it, return it. And Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. It's all part of their 100% fit guarantee. This is hands down the most comfortable bra you'll own, with straps that won't slip, tagless labels, lightweight, super thin memory foam cups. They even have a line of incredibly soft and breathable cotton bras. And how do I know this, folks, despite the fact that I don't wear bras? Because I outsourced the testing of the bras. This is what we heard back. I love they don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two, both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most t-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details so I don't feel basic. Right? Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra. And get 15% off your first purchase. Remember, you can wear it for 60, what is it? 60 days. And if you don't, you return it.
Figure it out.
Buy a bunch that first time because you get 15% off. I hope I'm not.
Thirdlove.com/majority
for 15% off today. And also, folks, the Majority Report is being supported in part by Simple Habit. It's a mobile app that provides a massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. Do you meditate?
No, I should start though.
Yeah, well, this would be the way.
There you go.
Majority Report audience and even guests can try Simple Habit totally free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. Alex, why would you start meditating?
I've got some anxiety, like all of us. like all of us do, and sometimes you gotta try ways to treat it that aren't pharmaceutical.
There you go. Simple Habit has 2,000 guided meditations specially designed for different parts of your day and just about anything you might add you might be dealing with in life. They have guided meditations for mindfulness, meditations for anxiety, mm-hmm. for depression, for when you're having trouble falling asleep. I check off all these boxes. I got to start. Meditation when you're wanting to overcome procrastination or when you have something important going on at work. Meditations designed for parents. They even have meditations made specifically for when you're waking up or your lunch break or when you've just gotten home from work or when you're going to bed. Different people are trying to accomplish different things with meditation. Simple Habit is able to cater to just about anyone, regardless of what their goals are with meditation or how much past experience they have with meditation. This is what sets Simple Habit apart. They have so many varieties of guided meditations, and you have it all on one app. Simple Habit just won the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Well-Being App. It's available on iOS, Android, and web browsers. Check it out now, folks. It is simplehabit.com/majority, and my audience and guests can try it out for free for an entire week. If you're watching on YouTube, if you're listening to the show, we put the link in the description. Check it out. So, Alex, this concept of billionaires assuming they have no ideology and appealing to this notion of like, it's going to be strictly competence for me. Mm. And I'm just coming in and we're going to put all of people's opinions and desires. Like, first of all, does this guy get into the room if he says, leave your egos outside? Like, can he even like walk in? But aside from that, this concept of no ideology in politics, right? Like you were talking about noticing something about what Beto and Pete Buttigieg say are their favorite books, and you can't build too much on this, but it is an interesting observation.
Yeah, because we hear a lot about how, and they're both extremely well educated, and they're both clearly very intelligent, but they talk about the books they love, and people who profile them talk about Beto's giant bookshelves and all these other things, and they only talk about novels, they only talk about fiction, and like Pete Buttigieg's favorite book list just came out today or yesterday, and it was 10 novels. And you know, Beto's favorite book is The Odyssey, and everyone talks about, you know, it's actually not totally, because they talked about presidential biographies. We're the only other thing I hear about Beto reading, which is like those don't really
Joseph
count.
Campbell-y,
but like they're never mentioning nonfiction books, never mentioning political books about like actual problems facing the country, you know, things like that. Because if I
That are going on, or I mean, it doesn't have to be that they're all reading like, you know, Michael Moore and, you know, Lying Liars, you know.
Yeah, totally.
But like, there's a lot of books that
Beto's like, there's was Sick Burn by Al Franken and Sean Hannity.
But there,
that formed my politics.
But the idea that you want to be president, and like, okay, there's two possible scenarios here, and the implications are not terribly different. But one is that they worked up a list of books beforehand, which and that they were, it wasn't just their favorite ones. It was like each book. I mean, and almost in some level, it would be political malpractice not to contemplate like these books are going to hit.
Do you think if it was purely cooked up, though? I bet they would have thrown at least one or two on that signified to some of the modern political concerns of like the Democratic primary.
Well, but here's the thing that I think. And maybe they would, or maybe they would. It almost doesn't matter, because that idea is still representative of like they want to their promise as candidates in some level is the polarization, the strum and drang or whatever that's called, the everything that Donald Trump represents, like how engaged you have to be in politics.
Yeah.
This is. I represent a release from that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, right. I mean, I think that's it, and I think the idea that So this is, if this is the audience you're trying to pitch your campaign to, it is the idea that, oh, we can go back to caring about Wolf Hall, and we can go back to we can go back to talking about our favorite novels and not having to read the Washington Post every day, or not, or even like we don't even have to read like the new Jim Crow and be worried about that, you know, like we can
and that has a big appeal.
It does to a certain part of the Democratic audience. Yep.
If Hillary were president, we'd be at brunch right now.
Yeah.
I mean, on some level, like that is I just distinctly remember that was the big takeaway when Bill Clinton was elected.
Right.
After 12 years of Reagan Bush, and it was really just like 12 years of Reagan is what the people felt. Everybody was just so excited to not have them in office. Right. And then like we don't have to pay attention to politics anymore. And that's basically what happened.
Yeah.
And I guess it's going to be interesting to see if that works.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I feel like that segment of maybe that segment of the Democratic base is like features a lot of people who donate to candidates, which I sort of lean towards thinking. But I certainly think for the majority of people voting for these guys or women, hopefully, the majority of the people voting are not part of that demographic. They actually have problems they want addressed, I think. But like the people they're sort of pitching their campaigns to are definitely the ones who are like, our material problems are much smaller than our sort of psychic problems with how the country is being run.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's also, you know, you can also look at the polling of like how many Democrats want compromise.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that has gone down.
Yeah.
And I think that the question is not so much just about compromise. The question is about like how invested they are in politics,
yeah,
and how aware they are of the dynamic. Because I think it, you know, like a reasonable person would say, like, yes, you need compromise.
Right, right. How if do these things that sound in a normal, well, free of context, are normal, mature responses
this is actually,
to things sound good versus actually understanding what the situation is?
This is actually what's really interesting and why I feel like Beto feels like a throwback in a lot of ways. It's because he's framing everything in these, because it used to be that was how Democrats just talked, where you would ask them, what's the biggest problem facing the country today? And they'd be like, well, we can't come together. We can't come together. Like,
there's no blue America. There's no red America.
And then now, but if
keep
you actually,
my lines out your mouth, white boy.
But if you asked, I feel like if you asked Democrats now, what are the biggest problems facing the country? They're not going to say, well, we can't come together. They're going to name actual material things for the most part.
Hey, do you think though that there's
we're
still
all just people who really liked our freshman year lit class? Okay.
I think there's also maybe, I think though there's among some of them, it's not can we all come together, but can we like get back to expertise? There's like a new version of that I see kind of manifesting in a way.
Oh, that's not new.
It's not new, but it's a different version than can we all.
That was
get
a Bush.
Together.
That was a Bush.
Oh, that's true. Right.
That was
truthiness.
Yeah, that was totally a Bush thing. Was like we got to get
right. Well, what do you think most Democratic primary voters would say?
But I think that is a standard. I think that is like, I mean, look, Democrats want good government.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and as nebulous as that term is, right? They just like I think there was always a sense, particularly with like, you know, the billionaire class and sort of the conventional wisdom, like we all agree. I think like the good faith conventional wisdom pushers were like, we all agree on what the problem is. Yeah. We're arguing about how to address it.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think it has become clearer to more and more people that we don't agree on what the problems are. And that's really ultimately what politics are, right? Like, coming up with the solutions is when you bring the solution people first, you are ignoring the fundamental reason why politics exists.
This is the thing that I feel like the argument people on sort of our side have been having with the centrists for forever now is it is they their insistence on, well, we all agree what the problems are. We have different ideas to fix them. And you can look at the entire history of how we've done healthcare policy in this country and say, like, do we agree with what the problems are?
No, we don't.
We clearly don't agree with what the problems are.
We don't agree what the problem is with immigration.
No, not at all.
And I don't just mean left and right. I mean, I think across the board, we don't any type of like consensus on what we should be doing in regards to immigration and
globalization.
Globalization. I don't know that we have on trade. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying, like, I don't think we do.
It's really...
We're doing a monetary policy. I mean,
on like, military.
Yeah. I just.
But also on military.
And there's one way to figure that out. It's through politics.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like, it's not. And like.
Well, we have an empty chair right here to represent the American people.
Represents the Democratic electorate on every show.
We're going to say, we all checked our egos at the door, and we're going to figure out what the problem is right now.
We're just going to figure out the solution.
We don't know.
What's the problem? No problem. Chair hasn't said a single word about what a problem is. We just didn't hear.
That's why we leave that chair open for the American people.
For the American people.
And if that you is, like the status quo, say nothing.
And that is what is so facile about what Schultz is doing. It'd be fascinating to me to see, like, if being on Fox gets him some Republican support.
Yeah.
And I can't help but think that, like, that Burton and Schmidt were like, you got to go on Fox first.
Yeah.
Because that way it makes it look like you're not going after the Democratic Party, even though we already told everybody.
Yeah,
they
kind of already gave the game away, which was interesting strategically to just tell everyone, oh, yeah, we're doing this because we're threatening them in case they nominate Bernie. But because obviously there is some slice of the Republican electorate that is basically the Evan McMullen crowd that is
right.
We've had enough of this guy.
Maybe Evan McMullen could be his running mate. That would be a powerful ticket.
That would be a Steve powerful Schmidt, ticket. If you're listening,
you know Steve, and because actually, and
I can't
could,
wait.
He could
to
do
see
a lot of
picks.
Work actually, because Evan McMullen really puts to bed a lot of ideas about like the intelligence of CIA officers and their savviness. And Howard Schultz is a walking demolition squad of CEO competence. Although I have to say, we were saying this on TMBS the other night because we always do that Steve Klubeck sound drop for basically everything. Remember the Keep It Simple guy, the guy with no neck from Diamond Resorts International.
Oh yeah, yeah,
who
yeah.
Looks
yeah.
like an extra in Showgirls. Yeah. Now he was on with Stephanie Ruhle like 8 months ago, saying everything that Howard Schultz is saying, like being like, "I'm going to cut the money off. Don't mention billionaires anymore." He would be a way better candidate than Howard Schultz because he's an everyman oligarch. His style would be so much more relatable.
The funny thing is we're already living in the world where the American people decided they wanted to put a businessman in charge.
Right.
We are already living in that world. They did not choose Bloomberg or Schultz. The American people said, you know what? A business owner, CEO type should be in charge.
They didn't
choose
Romney.
We want that one.
Right. Exactly. We rejected Mitt Romney. Who was that same guy?
Yeah.
I mean, this is why, you know, that was George Bush, right? The CEO president.
Yeah.
And there is, I think, more, I think there's probably more, broadly speaking, more appetite for that on the right.
Yeah.
I mean, or, you know, center right, maybe the center left as well. But I don't know. I'd be curious. I'm sort of fascinated now about who Howard Schultz might pick for his running mate. That's going to be worth the price of admission.
Yeah. Keep like, it simple.
That's the dude. Keep it simple.
We have another clip of Howard Schultz on there just because it's so fun. And it's so, it really is revealing of this group of people, right? Like, and the thing is that he's going to go in, he could spend hundreds of millions, I guess, on his campaign. It'll be interesting to see if he does that. But it also gives you a sense of like how twisted, you know, just imagine if one of these guys decided like, I'm not going to be president. I'm just going to be in charge of education. And then all of a sudden you get Bill Gates, right? Like that's, you know, Bill Gates, I think, is smarter, but he doesn't necessarily like.
Well, this is every time you hear about a billionaire pledging to give their fortune away to philanthropy, like they're talking about policy. They're not giving it in cash to the poor. They're talking about influencing policy every time.
Yes. And Bill Gates spent $750 million, maybe more, and completely changed the trajectory of where educational thought was going in this country for, you know, at least half a decade, maybe more.
A lot of data.
Maybe almost a decade. And at the end of that, commissioned a RAND report and basically said, we were completely wrong. And what the teachers and professional educators have been saying was right.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Nobody reported on it.
Yeah.
I don't think it made one national news broadcast. And it completely influenced and still reverberates through our educational system.
Is there any TV programs you'd like to demand apologies from for hosting?
There's a whole host.
Well, why should you listen to teachers when you could listen to education experts?
But that's the thing. They didn't listen to education experts. Like, they did not listen to educators, right? Like, people who had been trained in teaching. They listened to system analysis folks, and they listened to quant people. And then they just basically walked away, and I don't think the message necessarily has been fully absorbed. That, like, they were really wrong, like so wrong that they, even when they did their self-analysis. And so let's listen to Schultz make more of his pitch.
So it's March Madness. Everyone knows Monday night is a big game. Okay, so this week, Tom Izzo is from Michigan State, someone I went to school with. He was being interviewed, and he was asked, what kind of kids do you recruit for Michigan State? And he said there's three kinds of kids. Kids who like it, kids who love it, and kids who live it.
Fuck yeah.
I recruit kids who live it. Ladies and gentlemen, what we need to do as Americans is we need to start living our values. We need to start recognizing that we are in this together. Every problem that we have can be solved if we come together as a nation. We are all Americans. We're here tonight, Republicans, Democrats, Independents. Remember I said no hate zone? This can be done if we can solve our problems and come together. Do you agree with me?
Can I just say, like, I have no idea what he's talking about. Like, what is that?
Because you're so full of hate.
But living it means, like, I live and breathe basketball. Like, I play constantly. Yeah. Like, I wake up in the morning. It's not a question of, like, should I go out and practice? It's like, there's nothing I want to do other than practice. I don't understand what that means in the context of us living our values.
I don't know.
There's nothing I want to do other than triangulate. Say Pavlov, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah.
Like, I just don't understand what that means.
I wake up eager to find the exact midpoint between two competing ideologies. I live and breathe.
And well, that's the thing is that
I live
you
and
know,
breathe fiscal responsibility and social tolerance.
But
so wait,
this is images of Tom Izzo going at one of his players and yelling at him, and the kid looks like he's completely like he's like, Coach, I didn't do it.
He's living it right there.
He's living it. So but that's the point. It's like that's what living it is.
Yeah,
like he just said no ideology in the other clip, and that's what living it is.
Right.
It's like. I'm going for this.
Yeah.
Like,
Can we do, this gives me an opportunity to talk about the Schultz thing that I cannot believe no one has actually done this reporting yet. Because, like, it's already sort of known that he's not truthful about his own biography. He went to Michigan State. No one knows why or how. Because he grew up in New York City. And he was in this middle-class public housing. That was, like, the nice public housing for middle-class white families. CUNY and SUNY were free at the time if you lived here. No one was going to a state school in another state if they were, like, qualified to get in.
Maybe he was living and breathing it.
I guess he was living and breathing it.
Maybe he was living and breathing
it. But he has, in the past, he has claimed to have gotten an athletic scholarship, and then he revealed that was not true.
That's so weird.
So, like, why did he go to Michigan? Like, what was he doing at Michigan State? Going to a public, like, it's not like he went to Harvard. He went to a public state school in another state, had to pay money for. When he could have just gone to school for free in New York.
That is really weird.
It's really weird.
Maybe he pissed off
some. It's just weird that there's no story. It could have been like, I really, really had a crush on a girl.
Right. But like his original story was, I got an athletic scholarship. And that turns out not to be true. So now there's just no story.
We need to imagine a scenario where you don't dump me and I go follow you to Michigan.
But anyway,
That is some real old economy Howard shit, too. Can we appreciate that?
You know how we get to how we make fun of Chuck Schumer for having an imaginary family that he runs his bad ideas by and then they reconfirm them for him? I think that Howard Schultz has such an incredible lack of moral imagination that he doesn't even think he needs imaginary people in his own head to talk to.
Right.
And maybe we need
a
solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
I just love how Bill Burton so clearly in that clip. Bill Burton is just why Steve Schmidt seems genuinely whiny and aggrieved, and Bill Burton is just dude, you hearing what I'm saying? And if you can see my bank statements right now, it would be so funny to you too.
Bill Burton must have talked to his buddies, and I wonder what those. I have a vague notion of what those conversations were. People were just
"Dude, to be a multimillionaire.
Take the money. Yes. Take the money." And you're not going to be hurting anybody. He's not. Maybe it's he's not going anywhere, or maybe I wonder.
Why is Schmidt so bitchy about it, though?
Well, because he is doing exactly what he criticized his former friends supposedly. Yeah.
Right.
You know, literally there are clips of him going I just found out the whole conservative movement is a graft. And that it's just a scam.
Oh,
and
okay.
And then all of a sudden he's multi-million-dollar contract.
Okay. Maybe he really believes in him. Who knows?
Listen, I will cop to this. There is a number. I'm not sure what it is.
Oh, of course.
But, if I had to take a leave of absence from the show, folks.
Howard Schultz could set up 500 dummy Patreon accounts. Just throw them in. That'd be good. Let's just knock TMBS up to our next 3,000 patrons, and I'll tell you how to imagine a new possibility.
Well, no, I mean, it's not inconceivable to me to imagine that there would be a number where I'd be listen, I got to take 6 to 8 months off the show. I will explain in a year and a half as to why I'm doing this.
Right.
And
that would be great.
I mean, with Schmidt too, it's if you're one of the dozen genuine never Trump Republican guys, your paydays are limited.
Right.
Who's going to hire you?
Right.
No one's going to hire you. Well,
he had a decent podcast that was doing pretty well.
But he had an MSNBC. It is interesting that he had an opportunity to live to his principles and be totally comfortable.
Yeah.
And right.
It was just did have that opportunity.
Right.
I think obviously.
Yeah, you don't know.
It was literally he's bankrupt.
You don't know. Maybe he has, a sick family member who has no health insurance. I don't know.
And we need to make sure that they stay without health insurance.
It is. Right. You could have severe gambling debt.
He owes
money
to some of the same people that Brett Kavanaugh might have owed money to.
McCain was famous actually for losing tons of money gambling.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he would gamble for an entire weekend and just lose a fortune.
That's cool.
But
he had married into
money.
Call his daughter up. All right,
let's talk about somebody.
Fuck you.
Who's really living it? Mitch McConnell.
Yes, he is.
He's living it.
His latest move has been to, and I don't know if it's quite officially happened yet, but he's going to get rid of a procedural blockage to judges being nominated, where you're allowed to hold the floor for 30 hours.
You have 30 hours and then...
And people should understand it's 30 working hours. So it can really slow down the process, not dramatically. It can slow down the process. I don't know how to really sort of quantify it, but it can slow down the process of how many judges you get in. He's going to get rid of that. He's gotten rid of blue slips. It's pretty. He is completely remaking the judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
And just to remind people about the implications of it before we get into this, here is today a federal court in Kentucky. 2-1 decision, Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And this is really stunning in terms of understand, and I don't want to get too far afield here, but the whole Janus case, which kneecapped public sector unions, is that by forcing people to pay an agency fee to the lawyers who negotiate your contract if it's under a shop. You are infringing upon the free speech rights of a non-union member because they're having to give money. This judge, John Bush, appointed by Donald Trump, says that it is okay under the First Amendment to force physicians to do something that is completely not medically necessary for them to do their job, which is to perform. And I don't know if it's to actually like perform it on the specific women, but to show and describe a fetal ultrasound to patients before performing an abortion. It's not even on the woman necessarily.
Christ.
It is just like, it is basically, you need to go to an anti-abortion organization and sit there and watch a mandatory a movie, essentially.
And, why do you support this, Alex?
But this is, so this is just one example, and there are a million examples of the implications of a circuit court judge being appointed by Donald Trump, because these are about as far right wing judges as we've seen, I think, appointed, and they've been pretty far right wing. McConnell has orchestrated all of this almost unilaterally.
Yeah. And I mean, it's his like sort of ultimate political project, and it's been going on like. You know, he's been working on it since the 90s, basically. But him and the Federalist Society have been in lockstep this entire time, and like they're getting their way, like they're just winning, and they're going to have installed these people who are going to be basically legislating from the bench for decades to come.
I mean, just like what point do you think McConnell, was this a question of McConnell? Because certainly the Garland thing, right?
Like, yeah,
I think that empty seat on the Supreme Court is one of the most underestimated reasons why Donald Trump is in the president.
Oh, yeah, right? Totally. Yeah. And like, so this is what I wrote about, and I have the cover of the New Republic. Pick it up at your newsstand. So I wrote about McConnell. And he sort of says as much, but I think you can look at how Donald Trump won. And on the one hand, he genuinely convinced a bunch of people who don't normally vote for Republicans to come out and vote for him, because he was out there saying every day, like, I'm going to fight for Social Security. We're going to get out of these wars we're in. He was out there talking like a non-Republican. And McConnell was the one telling everyone, reassuring everyone, oh, by the way, he will govern like a Republican, meaning specifically he's going to appoint the judges we want.
Well, he was holding up a list.
Yeah.
Trump was holding up a list made by the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society that was basically like, here's my one promise to you.
Yep.
And that was the indication, right?
Yeah. And that's how you get a coalition together of like people who want to reject everything, and then people who are like, yeah, all right, you know, he's gonna like the evangelicals and the everyone else are
that's,
like,
I think that's it's it. The evangelicals.
I mean, that's how he got mobilized. Yeah, he mobilized.
He was able to mobilize the evangelicals despite the fact being the most profane,
yeah,
like example of humanity that you could imagine.
What?
So that also like so McConnell too, he that him sort of in the background with Heritage and Federalist Society, like getting Trump on the same page on judges, it was also the signal to like all the Republican establishment, like, all right, I guess like we don't actually need to prevent this guy from getting the nomination. Like we actually can just sort of sit back and see what happens. And McConnell's classic move is to sit back and see what happens. It was like after the Access Hollywood tape, people are rushing to get statements out rejecting Trump. And McConnell's just like, let's see how this plays out. He does it all the time. He just like doesn't talk until he sees how the situation is going to play out.
I am amazed at how much the Democrats and the media failed to hold Ryan and McConnell to account for any part of this.
I know. Yeah.
Crap show.
I know.
And McConnell just seems to me to be uniquely devoid of shame.
Oh, yeah.
Like
like
his statements that he came out the other day saying like Obama should have done more to stop the Russians from interfering in the election.
Yeah.
That's stunning. Just to remind people why that's so stunning.
So the intelligence agencies are saying like well, Russia keeps hacking these emails and is trying to basically interfere in the election to hurt Hillary Clinton.
And they had tested like their ability to get into voter rolls. Too,
yeah, they had been sort of trying everything. It was like a kitchen sink. Like, let's just sort of mess around in all these little edges around the election. And like, so they brief Congress and they brief the leaders of Congress and Obama and the is like, let's all put out a statement condemning Russia for doing this just so that like people know that it's going on. And McConnell's like, no, like he's like, I'm not signing on to any joint statement with you. I think his sticking point was like, you're not allowed to say that they want to help Trump win. Like, I'll be like, Russia, don't interfere. But you're not allowed to actually tell the truth about what's happening. So he refuses to sort of be the Republican signing on to the statement condemning Russian interference.
So he, at that point, is on board, or is that that's all part of his, like, I'm going to see how this shakes out.
Yeah,
as long
totally.
As I don't have to take any position that will like sort of commit me to being on any side of this ledger.
Yeah.
Because he's worried in Kentucky, right, theoretically, of like a primary at one point, too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a couple years ago, he actually, in the end, he won handily, but he was so unliked by the base that, you know, there was a lot of energy around finding someone to primary him.
People forget that McConnell, like, if you listen to Mark Levin or any of those people on right-wing radio at that time, McConnell was demonized by them.
Oh, yeah.
Big
time. Yeah, and it's always been crazy because he's, you know, he's by far the most effective Republican politician of the modern era. Like, in terms of achieving conservative ends and in terms of consolidating Republican power, I don't think you can point to anyone else who's been as effective as him. But they hate him because they know he's not actually, in his heart, a true believing conservative. He began his career basically as a quasi-Rockefeller Republican, which I sort of have come to believe was purely strategic and not out of any sort of actual belief in like moderation, because it was the 60s and 70s and you could still sort of believe that was the way forward but the day Reagan gets elected, he's suddenly a Reagan conservative, and they know he doesn't actually believe it. He was never like one of the sort of young fire breathing ultra right wingers, but so then they didn't trust him. But it was also this thing where I think during the Obama years, they were just so mad that Obama was in office that any Republican who was in office was like blamed for allowing that to happen.
Right.
so like McConnell is stymieing Obama at every turn, but it's still like, you let this man be president. Like, why aren't you doing something?
Right.
About
why
that?
Aren't you arresting him for being a non-American citizen?
Yeah.
So does McConnell just have no, like, I mean, because he's putting on an incredibly.
Yeah.
He's not just like he's not going for the record of how many judges get seated during a term of a president. These are hardcore right wingers. You know, folks who think Social Security was like the day that we went communist in this country. The folks who think that, this is. People make jokes about a Handmaid's Tale, but like, so does he care about that, or is it just like he wants to leave a mark on this country and he doesn't really care what the mark is? He just knows that this is going to cut deep.
I think his personal ambition is primarily to have left a mark, to have been an influential and important person. But I think that with the ideology of the sort of people he's putting on the bench, like, so McConnell, he used to be pro-choice. He used to not care about any of that stuff. I think the social conservatism is partly just political strategy. But I think that he has the sort of oligarchic, like, because what he sort of started off caring about was campaign finance and specifically about helping rich people help him get elected. And I think that actually sort of became the driving principle, was this sort of cycle, like, reinforcing itself where, like, the rich get to influence elections to help people who help the rich get elected in perpetuity. And sort of, and I think that the real point of these conservative judges is to dismantle the regulatory state and sort of prevent a New Deal from ever happening again. And I think that's sort of the all the stuff the evangelicals care about is sort of like just like a bonus for them. But it, like the real project is just
oh, that's interesting.
That's my sort of feeling on what
that
he
makes
believes.
A lot of sense. So just like having the he has one issue set in terms of the regulatory state, which makes sense coming from Kentucky, right?
Yeah.
Like he doesn't want we should be doing every. We should have coal cars.
Yes. Yeah.
And
he's been back when there were back before they all sort of consolidated. Tobacco was a big backer of him, and but coal's always been it's a huge huge part of his campaign war chest has been coal, and like so he came from.
I mean, that's the story of the Republican Party, though, isn't it? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, on many
yeah.
respects, it's like the primary agenda is to roll back the regulatory state in any fashion, and the support that the government gives to people generally.
Yeah.
I mean, more specific, he likes some specific support, narrowly tailored to wealthy people, but everything else is just sort of like. Are barnacles to them that are irrelevant, but also bring along a lot of support.
Yeah, yeah, and I think too, like they know. I think McConnell knows, and this is actually another reason why he might not be that popular among the base. McConnell knows and has always known that his agenda is extremely unpopular, and. This is why his number one move is to sort of hide in the background and fade into the wallpaper. Because he knows he is not personally likable. He is not charismatic. He has always won elections because he has outraised his opponent. At first, it was because he was outraised his opponent. And then now it's more because Kentucky politically has become a lot more conservative. And so the point of the judiciary is to prevent small-d democracy, is to circumvent it. And that's been... I think that's been the project basically since they realized it was a lot harder for them to win national elections.
Why do you think the Democrats have never like run against Mitch McConnell in the way that the Republicans run against Nancy Pelosi?
I mean, the Democrats always assume the electorate they're looking for is like half Republican, right? Like they always assume that the people they need to win over are ones who secretly in their heart of hearts want to vote for the Republican but need to be convinced to vote for the Democrat. So, like, they don't... And McConnell, too. I mean, Democrats don't believe in villainizing people. They really, really, really don't believe in villainizing people. He really is allowed, I guess, to get away with so much, which is funny.
So, related question. Why do you think it is that McConnell has made his career... pandering to the most extreme reactionary elements of the base of the Republican Party and telling them you can have everything you want and been very successful in that, whereas the Democrats do not seem to have that strategy on the left?
Well, we know the Democrats, like this is a cliche in politics at this point, but Republicans are scared of their base and Democrats sort of hate their base,
right.
Which is like that's the cliche. And the incentives are just so wildly different because the media ecosystem is so different, especially now. Like Murdoch really, really like Murdoch and talk radio completely changed
right. The
way Republicans relate to their own base. And Democrats don't have like... I mean, because so many of them still, they like getting their news from CNN and NPR, like no one is pushing them to be like, demand more of your Democratic representatives.
Right.
I think they might be a little scared of their base, too.
I mean, they're becoming a little bit more scared of their base now, but that's a very recent development.
Or yes. At least their potential base
yeah.
as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think that's what, like, AOC is...
That's what the DCCC, that's what the entire
exactly.
story of the DCCC thing.
Exactly. Is. The DCCC thing is, the DCCC, and I think we mentioned this when they announced this policy, and they supposedly had this policy...
It was like an unofficial...
It was an unofficial policy, which is, if you go after... if you are a contractor, you have a political shop or you're fundraising or you make signs, political signs or whatever it is, and you work for a primary challenger.
To any Democratic incumbent,
they will not give you...
they won't give you work.
They'll,
yeah. You won't get to work for any other campaigns. And all these consultants basically rely on... the DCCC and other organizations to find work every election
cycle. So, and that just the idea that they're putting it out there is just meant to have a chilling effect.
Yes.
Yeah. And I guess the real question is, like, part of the problem is if the RCC or whatever it is had done the same thing, everybody would be like, that's fine, because the Koch brothers.
That's the other thing, too. So the incentives matter, too, in terms of the money. And so McConnell, his whole deal, starting from the second he got elected to the Senate, was campaign finance reform. But he would do it in this way where it was originally – because campaign finance reform used to be quote unquote bipartisan. Everyone agreed we should find a way to limit money in politics. And then it was a Howard Schultz thing. It was like, well, we all agree this is a problem and we just disagree on the solutions. So McConnell's game for like the first decade of his career was just deciding what sort of campaign finance regulations he supported based on what he thought would be helpful to Republicans and what would harm Democrats. But as everything sort of got rolled back and as income inequality meant that the rich were getting richer and richer and they were using their money to more directly involve themselves in politics, he just sort of came to be like, well, you know, I guess we shouldn't have restrictions because there's this like more money just helps our side. Because it used to be sort of arguable with when unions were more powerful that more spending could be beneficial to Democrats. But like now it's like clearly money's on the side of Republicans. But he also sort of when he did support some restrictions, it was out of this establishment Republican belief that we can't just let the rich people sort of dictate everything because, you know, we need to keep these things within the party institutions. We need to keep them giving to our party institutions so we have some control over it. Like they don't actually they don't love having to like dance for at what the Kochs and the Mercers say.
Of course not.
They don't like that.
Yeah, because they're all they all have their own egos.
They all have their own
specific agendas of how to do evil things.
Yeah. So he would have, yeah.
People can argue. That's where you do have that agreement. Like we all agree that this is not a problem. We just need to figure out how to avoid dealing with it in our own unique way.
We all want to take food out of children's mouths.
Exactly.
The question is, how do we get there?
Right. How do we starve the people? Great. We all agree we should starve the people.
McConnell, Howard Schultz. No one in this room.
What is this video now that Meghan McCain had problem standing up for Mitch McConnell?
So Adam Parkomenko, who was of Ready for Hillary fame, found a video of Mitch McConnell stumbling and posted it. And Meghan McCain then defended Mitch McConnell. So do we want to watch the video of him stumbling?
I mean, I think we should.
Yeah, we probably
should. Just for full...
For context.
Journalistic reasons.
Adding the music might be a bit corny, but...
There you go. And... Meghan McCain found that video to Mitch McConnell had polio as a child and his leg is partly paralyzed because of it. Again, where is our empathy and compassion? Fight him on policy if you disagree with him, but this is just gross and heartless. And I mean, I think, you know, public figures get made fun of. And I think like that's
it's not being big.
I have a feeling like denying hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, health insurance a little bit more gross.
You know, guys, there's a movement in this country
where is our empathy?
People losing health insurance to making fun of Mitch McConnell falling, and that's really scary.
Parkomenko is funny. He's like
who is Parkomenko?
He's a complete psycho. Hillary Clinton. He had some title on the Clinton campaign. Okay. He was like
he started Ready for Hillary.
Ready for Hillary, and then his title on the campaign was like head of grassroots or something.
Oh, so he's
He's one of those. He's one of those people who believe. He's like almost like a David Brock type, where he's one of those people who believes we got to fight as dirty as they do, but their way of doing it is just so confusing. And because it's never like for anything. So he's like, for him, he's like, this is, you know, I'm fighting dirty just like they do. And it's like, here's a video of Mitch McConnell falling over.
That is great. They set up secret oppo research and laundered false information through the New York Times. You know what I'm going to do in response? Look at Mitch McConnell falling. He's a fucking loser.
It's like a Muppet trying to be mean or something.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we got to take a break. We come back. Dave Feldman, do you want to stick around? We're going to make fun of Bill O'Reilly, I think.
Yeah.
And, yeah, good.
I like to stick around.
All right. I'm glad to hear that. We have other videos that we will play today. Quick break, and then David Feldman will be with us. Ladies and gentlemen, it is always an honor to have our next guest on this program, someone who I watched with great admiration as a young, bushy-haired, big-eyed, what is that? I can't access things.
Bright-eyed, bushy-tailed.
Thank you. Stand-up, I would see this guy perform. In a basement in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and was always thought maybe someday I'll have the opportunity to talk to him on the phone. And that day is again arrived. Ladies and gentlemen, David Feldman. Welcome to the program, David. Host of the David Feldman Show, right?
Yeah. Yes. That basement that I perform in was featured in Capturing the Friedmans. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, wow. What? That's for the real head.
Is that true?
Wow. The one in Feldman coming in
hard.
Wait
a second. It was in the Catch a Rising Star up there? No.
No.
I used to dress as a clown. I don't want to talk about it. My dad used to teach computer to young. Forget it. Let's talk about the importance stuff. And thank you for inviting me
horrible,
back. I really
horrible thing
appreciate
to say.
I'm sorry?
So, David, just tell us a little bit about your show. What's going on with your voice?
Well, I'm just waking up. And so it's first thing in the morning. So can I just say something? I'm surprised you're having me back. And I won't mention the toupee.
Okay.
That I was told not to mention, and the bridge work, your bridge work. I'm not going to mention
that.
Oh,
thank you. I appreciate that, right? Yes. Okay. What? But why is that?
But the Democratic Party. I'm sorry?
Why is that a surprise?
What?
That we've had you back.
Because we don't agree on some things. And I want to say to your listeners that the Democratic Party is not heaven. Unlike heaven, the Democratic Party has room for everybody. So there's room for you. There's room for me. And, you know, we agree that Trump has to go. And that's all that matters. Let's just stick together. These ideological purity tests that you and Michael Brooks are—they're insane. Just, you know, let's get rid of Trump, okay?
What
you know me?
No, I know. I know you, of course. What are the tests? What are the tests that you feel like you're failing?
I feel like when I'm around you and I'm around your listeners, they don't want me in the tent because, you know, I supported the invasion of Iraq. Iraq, as I call it. I want to nuke Iran. I think we I want to reverse the Civil Rights Acts of 64 and 65.
Right.
I'm pro-oil, and I think some people are born winners, some are born losers, and that should be reflected in how the invisible hand rewards us in the free market. But I hate Trump.
Right.
And I have I think there's room for me in the Democratic Party as long as we don't cannibalize ourselves.
Right, right. Well, I mean, those are there. I mean, there's a couple of those things that I feel like are a little cause a little friction, don't you think? Or no?
Here we go. Here we go. 1972, George McGovern. Here we go. This is why I put on a hard hat and beat up hippies. I became a Reagan Democrat exactly because of what you're talking about. There's room for everybody in the Democratic Party.
Right.
Okay?
Right. But now, if that's the case, like, what distinguishes it from the, let's say, the Republican Party?
The Republican Party, it's Trump's, and I hate Trump. Trump has to go. And there's room for me. I'm socially conservative, but I'm fiscally liberal. You know that about me. I don't care how big, I don't care how big the deficit gets. Just so long as marriage is between a man and an obedient woman. And I think we're going a little too quickly on interracial marriage. I'm just saying, let's slow it down a little.
Slow it down.
You just there's room for me in the party. Don't cannibalize the Democratic Party.
It's true. We have been pretty accelerationist when it comes to marriage between races. And we've been really pedaled to the metal on that thing, and I guess to bring about, you know, to heighten the contradictions a little bit.
It's just something. I'm a Democrat, and marriage, you know, let's just say, okay, you know, let me just get used to it. Okay, let me just get used to it.
Used to the institution of marriage. Decide. Okay, right. Okay. No, I got you.
Security tests. Yeah. So I'm socially conservative, fiscally liberal. I agree that we should spend away. We should rack up debt, free tuition at all public universities, basic universal income. But marriage, man, obedient woman.
This is closer to the actual center of the country than we hear on almost any mainstream news network. So thank you for bringing that forward. Like, this is what Morning Joe would sound like if they actually represented mainstream opinion.
Is that Alex Perrine?
Yes.
I'm here.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, that was Michael, but Alex Perrine is here. Do you have a bone to pick with him?
No. I had him on my show like 5 years ago when he was reviewing snuff videos for Maxim. He's great.
Life of the freelancer.
Gotta shovel some shit to get to the gold.
Did you ever write for Maxim, though? I really hope.
No.
It's so awesome.
Their editors wouldn't take my call.
All right, you gotta get on.
I love watching your show. It's like the Paris Review. You have all these like literati, and you're too busy to hang out with me. Michael Brooks and I double dated with his new girlfriend. Barry Weiss.
Michael, are you dating Barry Weiss now?
I can't say yes to that bit at all.
Wow, you really talk out of turn, David. That's really...
That's the fake news.
We went out in Brooklyn, Barry Weiss. I took my lady and...
Do you want to share with us? Would we know who your date was?
Barry Weiss's older sister.
Barry Weiss's grandmother. And I see Barry is... Now, here's something that... Michael Brooks and Barry Weiss, they make a really cute couple. It's like Spencer, Tracy, and Hepburn. There's just a little tension. And they're really cute. And I found out Barry is her middle name. Did you know this?
No.
Her first name is Dingle.
Oh my god!
Did you know that? Dingle Barry.
What is the matter with you?
I'm here for it.
Dingle Barry Weiss, and they make such a cute couple. You and I both have had successful marriages. I've had a few more successful marriages than you. I've had about five more successful marriages.
Well, the point is,
you have had, and
you need to wrap them up to make them successful. You need to like basically close the loop.
They need to,
as it were,
to succeed.
Right. Yeah. There needs to be
you need to win the marriage.
Right. You need to
declare
need
victory.
Finish the narrative. The narrative.
Close the deal.
Right.
And one of the things I noticed between Michael and Dingle is that they're compromising. But Michael is turning into the man that I want him to be. He's going to be a great husband. At dinner, we were having an argument, a discussion about Israel vis-a-vis, you know, America's response to Israel. And you know, at first I noticed, and this is just wonderful to watch somebody grow up, Michael was all in on BDS. But by the end of the evening, he got Barry, or Dingleberry, Weiss, she completely caved on BDS. She's all in on bondage, discipline, and submission. And I'm...
This is really disturbing.
Did you write this out before you came on, or I hope this is just coming up now?
No, I'm just looking at my notes here. Now, Alex Perrine, are you still a fan of Bastinado?
I'm sorry?
Bastinado? Oh, sure.
Yeah, sure.
Cheaply.
All right, well, David, this is, I wanted to
I liked
to discuss.
Jimmy Dore better.
Yeah.
my flamethrower is in the shop. So I can't do that.
No, let's talk about your good friend Bill O'Reilly. Now, my understanding is that you guys started out together in show business, and then your paths diverged, and now he's you guys have come back around in many respects. He's on Newsmax TV, which I know that you were up for the slot, and you didn't get it. Maybe it was because of anti-Semitism. Maybe not. I don't know. But
I sure hope it was.
So this is important stuff because Bill O'Reilly is talking about his experience at a Fleetwood Mac concert interacting with millennials.
There's a lot of millennials at the Fleetwood Mac concert.
And
there's
so
a lot.
Let's watch a little bit of this because real news. Better talk, Newsmax TV.
Hey, I'm Bill O'Reilly, and this is the Talking Points Memo. Last night I was at the Fleetwood Mac concert in Madison Square Garden, New York City, and I learned something. I already knew
Fleetwood Mac
was a terrific group. And it's just amazing to see Stevie Nicks, 71, Christine McVie, mid-70s, Mick Fleetwood, mid-70s, John McVie, mid-70s, perform for 2 hours and 10 minutes on stage. It's just amazing. 70s to 40, I guess. So they were great. And the crowd was
sold out. 70s to 40, how old is Bill O'Reilly?
So I got to see a lot of people. And it occurred to me that there's a change happening in America. So the crowd was equally
You ready
divided.
For this, folks? Now, hold up, pause it. The change, and I don't want to tip anything off, it seems to be that there are new people being born and growing older, and then they get to a certain age, and they're older than they were when they were born.
The change
that's
happening in America is Lindsey Buckingham has left Fleetwood Mac again.
Again.
I don't understand.
That was equally divided between boomers, baby boomers like me, who grew up with Fleetwood Mac, and then millennial Generation Z, younger people, primarily women, who admire Stevie Nicks and Christine McVie as feminine icons. So the baby boomers are watching the show, and they're fairly calm because they're old. All right? And they had a couple before they came in. They're mellow.
He's just talking about himself. Wait, I preloaded before I got to the show, he's saying.
Millennials, generally speaking, but I didn't see one without, watch the show with this in their hand.
It's like they're holding up a phone,
texting every song. And they were taking some pictures, but at the Garden, it's hard to take pictures.
I always text songs.
Because you're away, and the stage is lit, but it's not a picture kind of thing. Maybe they were recording.
Does he have writers?
They all had
this.
Somebody
must write
in their hand. Boomers, no.
It's doable.
Wow. Yeah, it's pretty stunning.
So I got loaded in Long Island. I got my Puerto Rican limo driver to take me. I always call the builder. I say, hey, let's go see Fleetwood, Javier, but you wait in the car. And then I was there, and everybody was well. It was really good. And I can't. These fucking kids are taking pictures.
Can we play it, like put up the speed so we can get to the payoff? Because I'm curious as to what the big change
I'll
in America.
I'll tell you what the payoff is, you fucking Jew. Society's imploding. I'm on Newsmax, and there's 30-year-olds seeing Stevie Nicks, who I used to jerk off to in the Inside Edition days.
All right, this is 1.2 speed.
I think, okay, 1.2 speed.
No. There, millennials are taking selfies and bending over like pretzels to try to get them in the stage and all that. A couple of things.
Okay.
The band is non-political. Now, I know the band for many years, and some of them are political, but they didn't do that. And they stayed away from all that, all right, which was good. So people don't pay a lot of money, and it is a lot of money to go see Fleetwood Mac, to hear entertainers spout off stuff. The music of Fleetwood Mac is classic. It's timeless. And there are some songs where you want to jump up and dance, and that's fine. That's fine. But the millennial Generation Z people would never sit down. From the time it started to the time it ended, they were standing up. And there were people behind them. You know, some of these people were 75, 80. Aww. And they couldn't see. And the millennials didn't care. Not at all. Because I saw a confrontation.
Pause. Some of us are loaded in our mid-60s and had to leave a major cable network because we called black women mochaccinos and asked if they wanted extra milk with that. And we were there, and we can't stand up because we're a little drunk. Those are some of the other people that might have been there.
This is all just about a story, a confrontation he had with a millennial. Right? Like this was just people were standing in front of him. That's basically what happened, I think.
What I've noticed about America, the way it's changing, is young people are always standing in front of old people now. That's one of the main things
that
about America.
Never happened before.
There was one guy who used to host Inside Edition that had a prominent placement at Fox News who was not standing up because maybe he'd had a little bit to drink, and there were people standing in front of him.
And there were people behind them. You know, some of these people were 75, 80, and they couldn't see. And the millennials didn't care.
They didn't care.
Not at all. Because I saw confrontations.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. I actually had one, but the guard left. All right, because I've been going there for many years. But this drunken guy stands right next to me in my party on the aisle. He didn't have a seat. He just kind of ran down, stood on the aisle, weaving like this. And I said, hey, sir, you're blocking our vision. And I gave him a look. And then I stood up, all 6'4" of me.
Oh, there we go.
And he ran away.
Oh.
He ran away.
And then the usher came and said, you want me to? And I said, no. So make sure he doesn't come back. So the people who were standing and dancing couldn't care less about if anybody could see or what they were doing. And some of these people were like gyrating, like I just hit my mic. That's what they were doing. And I'm going, you know what this is all about? This is all about narcissism. Right. And this is what's happening. Because this thing is you now. This is like your hand. It's an extension of your body. And if these millennials or Z people or whatever, they lose this,
Jay-Z,
but they don't have it. That's big.
I was surprised.
They gotta have it.
Jay-Z people,
and the boomers
concert,
too.
You know what I mean?
I'm not saying the boomers aren't doing this, but the younger Americans under 40 really addicted, and so everything is coming through this into here. It goes bing bing instead of coming from life into here. They have this in between them. Now what this does is it makes everything center around you because people are texting you, Instagramming you, Facebooking you, whatever you're doing.
Right.
You.
It's like Neil.
So therefore the mentality becomes, it's all about me. It's about me. The whole
life experience. You know
what's
amazing about this? Hold on, pause it. He is now finally coming around to doing Al Franken's bit from Saturday Night Live, the me generation, which is stunning.
Yes.
Bill O'Reilly has finally adopted Al Franken's perspective on the world. After all these years,
his delivery of, there were confrontations. I had one.
Just coincidentally.
Yeah, how dare people dance at a concert?
I know, that's the amazing thing. He's like, he's making an argument that is completely lacking in profundity, that phones allow us to mediate our reality, and then tying it into, and that's why people dance at concerts.
No, what you're supposed to do as boomers, you go to see Fleetwood Mac. It's like going to the symphony, and you get drunk. You sit there
like at the opera.
You pregame, then you go to the opera.
Are we done with it?
Down.
Are we done? Yeah, I think we've watched
and you
all
watch
that we can.
The goddamn performance.
I hope that millennial blocked him on purpose. I would have were him.
I mean, I'm surprised that people weren't protesting him.
Oh, you know, it would be so funny to be standing up right in front of Bill O'Reilly at a Fleetwood Mac concert.
I think I might just start going to Fleetwood Mac concerts with the hopes that I'm going to run into him and stand up in front of him.
I probably would have sat down, but now that I know Bill O'Reilly is...
He also just revealed that he wasn't in a box.
He didn't have a box?
He didn't have a box, yeah, because someone was standing in the aisle next to him.
Well,
yeah.
You could be in an aisle in the box, can't you?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a box type myself.
Right, no,
so
it must be. But if the usher's coming, the guy had access and could run away. It couldn't have been a box.
Yeah. Well, whoever did that basically a troop.
He knew they put him in a special section. It was a no spin zone section, so you weren't allowed.
That's right. That's what he was mad about when the millennials kept spinning.
I'm telling you, he brings it. He's obviously read Professor Ben Burgess's book because the logic is spectacular. If you listen to his conclusion.
Now, David, do you get up every day and watch O'Reilly on Newsmax? I mean, is that part of your daily ritual?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm actually writing a book with him about his experience at the Fleetwood Mac concert called Killing Soft Rock.
Oh, God.
He brings it home. If you watch it to the very end, he actually makes a really salient point.
Oh, really? Let's watch it. Let's watch it to the end. We only have like a minute left, don't we?
Oh, yeah. This is the thing where, you know, where you're making fun of him. But he puts a nice bow on this. And Alex Perrine, who's a great writer, he could learn about this in terms of structure.
Right.
All right, let's hear. Here we go.
Under 40, really addicted.
All right, go forward a little bit.
And
more.
So everything is coming through. Whatever you're doing. You. So therefore, the mentality becomes, it's all about me. It's about me, the whole life experience.
This is
me.
Why Dennis Miller's not on anymore, because he's taken his shtick.
And this plays out into politics, into voting, into how the country is run. I'm telling you, this socialism thing.
What?
This is what happened. It's not Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders. It's that. I want it. I'm entitled to it. It's a narcissistic point of view.
Right.
The government is to provide me with education, medical care, house, food, whatever. Give it to me. And if somebody has more than me,
he knows
I'm
what
taking
socialism
it from
is.
And here's another radical idea. You should be able to fuck up Bill O'Reilly's concert experience whenever you want.
And that's the Talking Points memo. I'm Bill O'Reilly for Newsmax reminding you.
So wait a second. So if I'm to understand this correctly, in a socialist country, everyone stands up at concerts? Is that what's going on?
Yeah. And everyone stands and dances in the aisle.
And the more you stand and dance, the more socialist it is.
Wow.
Socialism is when you run out of other people's views of the concert to obstruct.
To paraphrase Churchill, it sounds good until you can't see Stevie Nicks anymore.
Everyone under 30 who does not block views at concerts has no heart.
Before I was 30, I was a socialist at heart.
Oh, yeah. Socialism
after I was
is great.
70 and drunk,
socialism is great
socialist.
Until you're 85 years old and try to watch Maroon 5. And all these young whippersnappers are jumping in front of you.
Socialism is fantastic. So you're 90, multimillionaire, trying to watch the Rolling Stones.
Oh,
you know,
my God.
If anything, I mean, I know he's probably only talking about himself. I think baby boomers almost dance more when they go to concerts, in my experience. I brought my mom to a 24-hour drone festival a few years back. And she was actually annoyed that more people weren't dancing.
What hour was it, though? I mean, by by hour 22, I feel like people are just fried.
Yeah, it was the evening.
Okay.
It could have been dance. My mom danced. It was adorable.
There you go.
And at the DSA Christmas party as well that I helped put together, there were some really awesome baby boomers just dancing the whole time down in front. I took a video, so fake news, Bill O'Reilly. Yeah,
basically, baby boomers are the narcissists.
They might be, you know,
and you're dancing
breathless leg syndrome and, you know.
Well, David, thank you for introducing us to that that Bill O'Reilly segment. I feel like I figured it out now.
And they all have iPhones, yeah. So all of a sudden they think they should get health care. Anyways.
Alex Perrine texted me to do this joke. I don't think it's funny, Alex. He wants me to do it. Because it's not spontaneous. It was written down. He said, you do it. You're funny. I don't want to. He said this is going to be recorded for a new Fleetwood Mac album entitled Fuck It, We'll Do It Live. I don't find that funny.
Thank you for doing it. I think you delivered it much better than Alex would have, so yeah. I can tell you that right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
it's
David,
like it's punny.
David,
yeah, it's not funny, Alex.
If someone wanted to, listen to your podcast, what would they do? Or your radio show, right? It's a radio show podcast, isn't it?
Have silver fillings in their molars, IUDs. We found that people, women can hear my show if they have an IUD installed.
Right.
And, really?
And fillings in their teeth.
Wait, so what is the...
I noticed that you named it after yourself. Is that because of your phone use?
My phone use?
Yeah. Like, it's all about you, isn't it, David?
What does the O'Reilly factor fit into that whole narcissism spectrum?
My factor.
I mean, no, but I'm just saying, like, not only did you name a show after yourself, it was like your, well, yeah.
Well, glass houses, Michael.
Anyone who has ever hosted a cable news show has just no business diagnosing another person.
I know, it's unbelievable.
I'm sorry. I really
the guy
do
who, like,
I look
millions of
the,
dollars paid out
to the
because
Rachel
of
Maddow
his
in her
sexual
twilight
assault
years.
And sexual harassing.
Rachel Maddow's like, so we're at the Tracy Chapman concert, and this new generation, and she's going into Fast Car, which is her most famous song. I used to play it on the river. And
This is Ari Melber complaining about a Roots show 20 years from now.
Yeah, yeah. Used to be able to go.
That's
and everyone
so true.
Was excited to see Questlove.
And now they all have these chips in their head. The chip in their head. It's like, it's literally embedded in their heads.
And they're
now,
singing
we all have it embedded in our heads.
So all of a sudden, I'm not just hearing Tracy. I'm hearing them.
Oh, my God.
That's so funny.
David Feldman, thank you so much for your time
love
today,
you,
buddy.
I love you guys. Thank you.
I love you.
I love you
all
guys. Right.
Very much.
Right. Wow. Wow, that was, wow.
David Feldman is unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Thank you, Bill O'Reilly. The gift that continues to give.
I don't even remember the context, but my favorite Bill O'Reilly bit. We must have been talking about his divorce proceedings or something and just did the welcome to the family dinner. I'm Bill O'Reilly.
Oh my God.
I've been drinking.
All right, we're going to take a break and head into the fun half of the program. Folks, you can join us there by becoming a member of the program and going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you fund the daily free show. And then, as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every single day. Jointhemajorityreport.com, pennies a day. Also, check out justcoffee.coop. This is the month. You get 30% off. You don't even need the coupon code MAJORITY, although you can stick it in there just to let them know where you're coming from. And this is for the month for you to try all these different types of coffees they have. Find out which one you love. Then you just keep buying it with the 10% off coupon that Majority Report offers. You're going to try the Majority Report blend. You could try the WTF blend. I've heard it's not really that
as
great.
Relevant anymore.
But all the other blends are great. It's really not that relevant. Yeah, it's really
feeding Sam ever since tendencies here.
Yeah, ever since Obama went on that coffee, it's just not as interesting.
Not have the same kind of pop to it.
Yeah,
it's a little too bitter for me.
Yeah, exactly. JustCoffee.coop. Michael, today is Friday. That means that Tuesday happened earlier this week.
Correct.
What happened on that day?
On Tuesday, I hosted...
The tenor Andrea Bocelli.
That's so good. Oh, Jesus. We had on Kim Ives, the English language editor of Haiti Liberté, to talk about this wild story that broke in February of basically these U.S. mercenaries in Port-au-Prince essentially trying to move $100 million out of an escrow account into the president's private account. We went
Say,
into
baby,
the-
put down that pipe and get my pipe up.
That was the code name for the mission.
That was the code name for the mission.
Pipe up. Pipe up.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Okay. And then we had on, and then Malaika Jabali joined us in studio. We made fun of Beto O'Rourke and talked about why Hillary really lost Wisconsin and why that actually matters. Yes?
What?
I thought you didn't have another drop for that?
No.
Okay.
So you're not allowed to make fun of anybody ever.
On Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, Soumya Shankar talks about the Indian elections, and Felix Biederman of Chapo Trap House is going to talk about QAnon and the Gambino. Did you guys hear this story? That apparently the head of the Gambino family was assassinated in Staten Island a couple weeks ago.
By a QAnon guy.
Right, and at first everybody's just like, oh shit, maybe like the mafia wars are coming back. But apparently this poor bastard, after working his whole career to get in charge of a... honorable mafia family gets clipped by somebody who was probably like tweeting at us about how like we're covering up Pizzagate. So Felix and I are going to talk about that and a whole bunch more. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
It makes me furious.
Jamie?
This week on the Antifada.
Jesus Christ.
Oh my God. We spoke with Rona Lorimer from Commune Magazine about the Gilets Jaunes yellow vest uprisings in France that are still ongoing. A lot of interesting stuff is happening there. We also did a little musical lesson in Fugazi capitalism. And also, while we're on the topic of baby boomers and the things that they like, we had a little bonus where Sham Khanna, the editor of Commune Mag, came to give a little preview of issue 2 of Commune Mag. And then we surprised him with a merciless self-crit struggle session on a recent tweet he posted that was not okay. Would you like to know what it was?
No.
Blonde on Blonde is the best Dylan record. Prove me wrong.
Mm. Whoa. Mm-hmm. When did that album come out?
Blonde on Blonde?
66?
Definitely late 60s.
Okay. Well, it sounds like it's in the time zone where it's okay to pick a Dylan album.
Oh, yeah, you know.
Literary Hangover. There's a new literary hangover up. It's coming out on Saturday for everybody, but patrons can get access to the Soul of Man Under Socialism episode. It's an Oscar Wilde essay from 1891 where he talks about his sort of like anarcho-socialism leanings and how earnest he is about those.
I'm very excited for that.
The importance of being earnest.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll take your phone calls. We'll take your phone calls. And 646-257-3920 is that number.